Shabbat Shalom. Well, I'm going to speak about life beyond life, and I hate to start my lecture with bad news. At some point, how should I put it, we are all going to meet a dead end. So what are the options that the Bible opens for us for the next stage? You should know that biblical literature has one monolithic ideology. Actually, the Bible is a mosaic of ideas, and even when it comes to life after life, we can actually find different approaches, different points of view, different ideas for all of us. Actually, biblical literature, or the most of it, if you listen to the voice of mainstream biblical literature, it's an expression of very normative religion. But if you read between the lines, you'll still find many ideas which are still very close to traditions of the ancient Near East, to mythology, to paganism. And for instance, let's start with the most appealing one, which is, of course, eternity. People who are not going to die, people who are going to live forever and ever. And, of course, you know that already in the very beginning of the book of Genesis, God is afraid of our competition. You know, God does not believe in American capitalism. God wants a monopoly up in heaven, and he won't let us join him. And that's why already in the Garden of Eden, we have the tradition, after we have eaten from the fruit of the tree of knowledge, God does not want us to eat from the fruit of the tree of life. As we hear, number one on your handouts, now don't look at me anymore, look at your handouts, we are going to work now. So Genesis 3:22, and the Lord God said, now that the man had become like one of us, knowing good and bad, what if he should stretch out his hand and take also from the tree of life and eat and live forever? So, and that's why we are expelled from the Garden of Eden, and we are still looking for the way back to the garden. But another story in the book of Genesis, chapter number 6, is actually telling us a beautiful tradition, a tradition that actually is shared by many peoples who live around the Mediterranean Sea. We have these traditions in Greece, we have them in Canaan. Now that we know quite a lot about Canaanite literature, I'm sure you have all heard about the city of Ugarit in Syria. One day I'll take all of you there for a visit, but please sign up for the trip, but we'll wait a little. But anyway, in the city of Ugarit, we have discovered a huge archive in which most of the documents are very boring, you know, commercial stuff. But still, we have found there beautiful pieces of literature, of epic poetry. And there you find also traditions about people, you know, who never die, or about people who actually were born because some gods came down from heaven, had a relationship with the most beautiful girls down on earth, and the children who have been born, at the end of the day, they got promoted and they got tenure in heaven. Well, the same stories we find also in Greece. If you think about Heracles, I'm not sure you have read the story. If you haven't read, I'm sure you have been to the movie. So Walt Disney made a movie and made a lot of money. And the story of Heracles, just to remind you of a story, it's about Zeus, of course, you know, the head of the Greek pantheon, who desires the beautiful lady Alcmene, who is a married woman. He disguises himself as her husband and makes love to her. An hour later, her husband comes back, you know, from the army, and he too wants to make love to her. He's surprised to find out that she's not so enthusiastic to be with him. He doesn't understand why. But anyway, he wants it, so she's with him too. And the result is that she has twins. She bears twins, One of them is Heracles, the other one looks like me. And of course, at the end, Heracles gets promoted, becomes a god, and lives forever and ever. And that's something the Bible cannot agree with. How can a human being make it up to heaven? How can a human being become a god? Since we are a monotheistic religion, and the Bible is actually the manifesto of the monotheistic revolution, something like that is not accepted. But on the other hand, the Bible cannot reject the story. It's such a well-known tradition. It's such a popular tradition. So how can the Bible not tell it? If the Bible doesn't tell it, it won't prevent people from telling it again and again and again. So the way of the Bible to compete with this tradition is to tell it, but to make the necessary changes, minimal necessary changes. So let's look at the story, text number 2 on your handout. When men began to increase on earth and daughters were born to them, the divine beings, well, here it's written divine beings in the Hebrew original, I have almost said in the Hebrew translation, but in the Hebrew original, B'nai Elohim. B'nai Elohim are indeed, if you want, they are gods. If you want, these are like members of God's entourage, members of God's cabinet. And these divine creatures, you know, are coming down to earth. And when they saw how beautiful the daughters of men were and took wives from among those that pleased them, the Lord said, "My breath shall not abide in man forever, since he too is flesh. Let the days allowed him be 120 years. Pay attention, of course, to the number. It was then and later too that the Nephilim, the giants, appeared on the earth, when the divine beings cohabited with the daughters of men who bore them offspring. They were the heroes of old, the men of renown." So the Bible admits, well, there are giants. We still see them. Whenever we watch an NBA game, we see these giants. So you can't deny the fact that, you know, some divine creatures are still coming down from heaven, are still cohabiting with the most beautiful girls down on earth. But the Bible actually makes some necessary changes. And the most important one, of course, the children born to these giant or to these divine creatures are not going to live forever. They are not going to be like gods. They have to die like any of us. But the number which is the limit, the sky ceiling that no human being can cross, is 120 years. And that's, of course, a very meaningful number. Not just because we used to say bis 120, but also, of course, because we know somebody who actually lived for 120 years, and we'll get to him pretty soon. But before we get to him, let's get to Enoch. Enoch is a very interesting guy. Number 3 on your handout. Enoch was number 7, the 7th generation to Adam in the book of Genesis. And in Genesis chapter 5, you have a list of names, a genealogy. You know, in the book of Genesis, you get a lot of genealogies which are as interesting as the phone guide of Southern California. Actually, phone guides are very interesting. I've learned a lot studying carefully the phone guide of Jerusalem. I've learned a lot. But here and there, they stop for a moment and tell you an anecdote about the person. And here about Enoch, there is something very special. They don't use the terminology they use for all other members of this list, because about all others, we are telling that all the days that Sir X lived came to the number so and so, and then he died. That's what they say about every person on the list, except for Enoch. About Enoch, they say, when Enoch had lived 65 years, he begat Methuselah. After the birth of Methuselah, Enoch walked with God 300 years. That was a long walk. And he begot sons and daughters. And of course, you add together 365. All the days of Enoch came to 365 years. And no coincidence. Of course, you know the meaning of this number, the number of days of the solar year, which means that there was some connection between Mr. Enoch and some solar divinity. Who knows? Anyway, so Enoch walked with God. Then he was gone, for God took him. Actually, he was gone, for God took him. Well, this terminology is very vague, is not very clear. What does it mean, he was gone because God took him? On the one hand, I can understand it as if it's referring to his death. Because this very same terminology, I don't want to die, so I'll drink. This very same terminology is used in some other places in the Bible to refer to people's death. If you look, for instance, in Psalm 39, verse 14, number 4 on your handouts, "Look away from me," says the psalmist, "that I may recover before I pass away and am gone." Ve'eineni, meaning before I die. Or in Ezekiel chapter 24, verse 16, "O mortal, I am about to take away the delight of your eyes from you through pestilence." To take away, lokeach, the same terminology that we find in the Enoch story. And here it refers to death. But on the other hand, it's very clear to us the terminology which is being used for Enoch is very different from the terminology used for other characters on the list. So what is going on here? The author is afraid to be too overt about it. He tries to be as vague as possible. But you see that Enoch gets hardly any PR in the Bible. Only few verses are dedicated to him. But when we read post-biblical literature, Second Temple literature, we find a whole library dedicated to Enoch. First of all, we have two apocryphal books. We have the Ethiopian Enoch. We call it the Ethiopian Enoch because we are stuck only with the Ethiopian translation of the book. The Hebrew original got lost. A Hebrew book that didn't make it into the Bible, you know, was lost. But we read this beautiful book of Enoch, and we see how he, you know, left the earth and made it up to heaven, and we follow his flight through the seven heavens until he reaches actually the throne of God, and he sits next to God. And then we have also the Slavic Enoch, again a Hebrew book which we have lost, but the translation of which was preserved to us in the language of the old Slavic church. And here again, a very similar story about Enoch. And about 50 years ago, a little more than 50 years ago, we discovered the scrolls in Qumran, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and in Qumran again, a whole library about Enoch. Enoch, the man who made it up to heaven. And of course, we all like to identify with a person who fought death, who didn't die, and actually lives forever and ever. You know, the rabbis, again, do not like Enoch. In the Babylonian Talmud and in the different Midrashim, you'll hardly find anything about Enoch. Normative Judaism rejected him. And if you do find something about Enoch in post-biblical literature, in rabbinic literature, they really hate him. They say he was wicked. They say many ugly things about him. And that's Enoch. So you see, it's very difficult for us Jews to accept that somebody did make it up to heaven. And here another example of the rejection of the tradition about a person that made it to heaven. That's the story about the death of Moses. Yes, Moses died. Moses died, number 6 on your handout, Deuteronomy chapter 34, verses 5 to 7, the very end actually of the Torah. So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab at the command of the Lord. He buried him, meaning the Lord himself buried Moses in the valley in the land of Moab near Beth Peor and no one knows his burial place to this day. How lucky we are. Just imagine what would have happened if we knew where he was buried. A whole industry would have started there, selling holy water, keychains with the portrait of Moses. And anyway, you know, holy sites like that, holy graves, give us a headache. Because graves and politics go very well together. So we are very grateful to the fact that we don't know where Moses was buried. But anyway, the mystery goes on. We hear that Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eyes were undimmed and his vigor unabated. Of course, Moses died in perfect health. Perfect vision. He has all his teeth in his mouth, and yet he died. And he died, of course, at the age of 120, which reminds you, of course, of the story we have discussed earlier in Genesis chapter 6. In order to tell you, yes, Moses is a human being like all of us. Yes, he is the one who reached the glass ceiling. He didn't cross it. And he is a human being. You see the effort of the narrator, a real effort to tell you and to convince you Moses didn't die. But here and there between the lines, you understand that the fact that you don't know where Moses is buried may be a result of the fact that Moses indeed has never died. And the tradition about Moses never dying, about Moses making it up to heaven, was not created by me. But was a well-known tradition, for instance, in the first century CE. And here you have the tradition as told by one of my best friends, Josephus Flavius Yosef ben Matityahu, in his Antiquities of the Jews. You know that Josephus Flavius, who was a general in the Israeli army, fought the Romans, then became a traitor, then left the country, lived in Rome, got his salary from the emperor, and when he retired, he looked for something else to do, so he wrote our history. And actually, he was a Talmid Chacham, and reading his history is a great pleasure. It tells you a lot about our traditions, about the way the Bible was interpreted in his own days. And when he gets to the tradition about the death of Moses, that's what he tells us, number 7 on the handout. And while he bade farewell to Eleazar and Joshua, and was yet communing with them, a cloud of a sudden descended upon him, and he disappeared in a raven. But he has written of himself in the sacred books that he died. He wanted to fool us all, so he wrote of himself in the sacred book that he died. And why? For fear lest they should venture to say that by reason of his surpassing virtue, he had gone back to the deity. So people did tell, of course, the tradition or the story that he went up to the deity, that he didn't die. Of course, if you think about some other guy in the first century CE that didn't really die but made it up to heaven, and another good Jewish boy, whose name was Jesus from Nazareth. And of course, why do you think the Christians are telling, or the New Testament, which was actually written originally in order to appeal to Jews, to accept him as the Messiah, why do you think that they tell about him that he did not die, of course, or that he did die actually, but was resurrected and made it up to heaven? Because they wanted to present him as a second Moses. If you follow the life story of Jesus in the New Testament, if you start, for instance, with the Gospel of Matthew, the first chapter, the second chapter, you see that you have there a Moses-like story that he is actually walking in the footsteps of Moses from the story of his birth. You know, when the King Herod learns that the Savior of the Jews has been born, and it's a great danger to his kingdom, so he kills all the children of Bethlehem, the way Pharaoh killed all the kids in Egypt. Jesus, meaning his parents, take little Jesus and they escape to Egypt. Then they come back from Egypt. They have their own exodus because, as we say in Passover, kol dor vedor chayav lirot et atzmo keilu hu yatza mimitzrayim. Every generation has to see himself as if he himself came out of Egypt, etc., etc. So, of course, even the story about him making it up to heaven follows the well-known story that was known to Josephus, that was known later on to the rabbis, that Moses didn't die. The rabbis in the Babylonian Talmud in Tractat Sotah tell us that Moses is actually, he's up there serving God. Moses actually did not die. Fine. Now, I have another reason to believe that this tradition about Moses was well known in the biblical period. Well, now I have to explain to you something very, very complicated in astronomy, a field about which I know nothing. I've heard this well-known phenomenon that a star that doesn't exist anymore, that, you know, died many years ago, the light, its light we can still get here down on Earth. So the story about Moses not dying but going up to heaven has been rejected, but its light we get in the story about another biblical hero, which is Elijah. Elijah, again, is a second Moses. If you think about the story of Elijah, you'll see that there are so many motifs common to both of them. Let me just mention one or two. For instance, in 1 Kings chapter 19, when Elijah goes to Mount Horeb, where he, of course, has a dialogue with God, he is the only person, except for Moses, of course, to get to Mount Horeb, to be there, to speak to God. God is speaking to him. Or, for instance, the tradition that we are going actually to look at right now, the tradition about Elijah crossing the Jordan the way Moses crossed for us the Sea of Reeds. Very similar. So, and about Elijah, we do tell that Elijah did not die. Of course, we reject, the Bible wanted to, or the writers of the Bible were interested in rejecting this tradition concerning Moses, because Moses is bigger than life. Moses, whose biography goes from the very beginning of the book of Exodus to the very end of the book of Deuteronomy, it covers four of the Chumashim of the Torah. Moses, who was our first leader, Moses, who carried us through the wilderness, Moses, who crossed the Sea of Reeds for us, Moses, who performed so many miracles for us. Just imagine what would have been if he would have made it up to heaven. We would have started Christianity about 1,200 years earlier. Because Moses could have been a Jesus. And that's what the Bible wanted actually to avoid. But with Elijah, it's not that dangerous, because Elijah didn't have such a good reputation. You, of course, know more of the post-biblical Elijah, who is a very nice guy. The post-biblical Elijah is almost like a Jewish Santa Claus. You know, so very friendly, or always appears to us, you know, to save us from all our problems. But the biblical Elijah is not a very nice person. He's always threatening, always there to punish us, always to tell God that we have committed crimes and we deserve punishment. Elijah is the last person you would have liked to meet in a dark street when you're walking alone. And so about Elijah, we can tell the story that he actually made it up to heaven, but even about him, let's see how and why the tradition was actually preserved. Number 8 on your handouts, 2 Kings chapter 2 from verse 7 to verse 15. I won't read the whole thing. Let's start with the second line. Thereupon Elijah took his mantle, and rolling it up, he struck the water. It divided to the right and left, so that the two of them crossed over, meaning he and Elisha, his disciple, crossed over on dry land. As they were crossing, Elijah said to Elisha, "Tell me, what can I do for you before I am taken from you?" Before I am taken from you. Does it ring a bell? Does it remind you of the story of Enoch that we read? Being taken again, but here being taken is not dying. Here being taken is making it up to heaven. So, and Elisha answered, "Let a double portion of your spirit pass on to me." "You have asked a difficult thing," he said. "If you see me as I being taken from you, this will be granted to you. If not, tough luck, it will not." As they kept on walking and talking, a fiery chariot with fiery horses suddenly appeared and separated one from the other, and Elijah went up to heaven in a whirlwind. Elisha saw it, and he cried out, "Oh, Father, Father, Israel's chariot and horsemen!" When he could no longer see him, he grabbed his garment and rent them in two. And then Elisha too crosses the Jordan like Elijah, like his master. He's using Elijah's mantle, which fell down from him, to cross the Jordan. And when the sons of the prophets or the young prophets in Jericho see Elisha actually performing the same miracle as his master performed, they all say, when they see it, "The spirit of Elijah has settled on Elisha," and they went to meet him and bowed low before him to the ground. Whom is this story about? This story is not about Elijah, but it is a story about Elisha. What this story is interested in is actually telling us that the true heir of Elijah is Elisha. The spirit of Elijah has rested upon Elisha. That's what we are interested at when we read this story. And indeed, this story is like the introduction to the story cycle about the great miracles performed by Elisha. So actually, we get this miracle about Elijah making it up to heaven indirectly. That's not the main interest of this narrator. And if you really read it again tonight before you go to sleep, please do it, yeah. So I have to leave you with an assignment, yeah. So if you read it again tonight, you'll find out that the moment Elijah makes it up to heaven, we are not looking at him anymore. We concentrate on Elisha. We concentrate on what's happening here and now down here, how Elisha communicates with the sons of the prophets from Jericho. We don't follow Elijah crossing from one heaven to another through the seven heavens. That's not of interest to us. And yet, think about it. The reason Elijah became such a popular person in post-biblical literature, it is because he did not die. A turn of 180 degrees takes place. Elijah, the way I described him, threatening, punishing, complaining, becomes this very nice guy in post-biblical literature. By the way, a funny thing is that Elisha, who is a very nice guy, disappears in post-biblical literature almost totally. He's not important because Elijah is taking his role. Elijah is becoming the nice guy in post-biblical literature. Now let me ask you a question. You all know the map of Israel very well. Even if you close your eyes, I'm sure you are familiar with the map. Where did Elijah start his heavenly ride? Osnat knows the answer. You'll get a prize later, Osnat, yeah? Yeah, they crossed the Jordan from Jericho to the other side, and that's the very place in which Moses died. So again, you see, the tradition about Elijah follows the tradition about Moses. So this, he had to cross the Jordan. Why does he cross the Jordan? If he wants to die, let him die on the West Bank. Why does he have to cross to the East Bank? But the reason he crosses to the East Bank, because that's our Cape Canaveral. That's where all our missiles actually take off. So again, you see that there was that's another proof that there was this tradition about Moses, who actually from that place made it up to heaven. Now, there is so one option, of course, is not to die, to make it up to heaven. That's one option, open to all of us. Another option is actually to be resurrected. And if we talk about resurrection, before we talk about resurrection, resurrection is a great idea. Okay, number 9 on your handout. Elisha died and he was buried. Now, bands of Moabites, and it's very important to remember that they are Moabites, used to invade the land at the coming of every year. Of course, in the Middle East, we start fighting in the spring. You know, the rain season is over, the land is dry, we can start fighting. We wait for this moment every year. So once a man, you know, was being buried, when the people caught sight of such a band of the invaders, so they threw the corpse into Elisha's grave, meaning, you know, people were buried in graves. So these guys who buried some men, some unknown men, they were frightened by the invaders, so they wanted to finish as quickly as possible with the funeral. So they threw the body of this unnamed person into Elisha's grave and made off. When the dead man came in contact with Elisha's bones, he came to life and stood up. He's still standing up. Nobody's waiting for him. It's a very funny story. Because usually in a miracle story, you know, somebody has to be happy about the miracle. Somebody has to thank the prophet for committing this miracle. But here, who's this person? Who's waiting for him? He was brought back to life. He's still standing there and waiting. He doesn't know what to do. He doesn't go home. We know nothing about it. And anyway, it's a very funny story. Because again, think about it. It starts with telling us that Elisha himself was died and was buried. If he's so good in bringing people back to life, what should be the question? Why didn't he bring himself back to life? You know, there are these funny stories, for instance, in Aesop's fables. For instance, about a fortune teller, a woman who sits in the market and, you know, tells people for a few dollars, she's telling them what's going to happen to them. And the moment she tells them what's going to happen to them, she doesn't know that at that very moment, her house, you know, was actually robbed of all her property. Or another story about an astrologer, you know, who looks at the sky, at the stars, and again tells the future. And when he looks up, he doesn't see what's going down there, and he falls into a pit and breaks his neck, and that's his end. So that's a way to tell funny stories about, you know, different types of prophets, fortune tellers, etc. And that's actually a story written by a person who knows that Elisha's claim to fame was indeed his ability to bring people back to life. But since we don't like this type of stories, we tell it, but not enthusiastically. And we leave it, you know, in a way that you can still ask your intelligent questions. The one I asked, because I'm a very intelligent person, why didn't he actually resurrect himself? Now, if Elisha is so very good in resurrecting people, there is actually a story, number 11. Let's skip number 10 for a moment. Let's look at number 11. Number 11, that's the story of the Shunammite woman. A Shunammite woman was a very rich, well-to-do lady, and she is married, and Elisha uses to pass through Shunem, through her city, every once in a while. So she tells her husband, why don't we make an upper chamber for this person, for the prophet, so whenever he passes by, he can stay with us. Elisha wants to show her how grateful he is, and he promises her a son because she is a barren woman. So, of course, a son is born, but a few years later, the son dies. And when the son dies, after she has already experienced maternity, she won't let Elisha go. Now she insists on Elisha bringing the child back to life. Now let's see how Elisha is doing it. I start with the third line. Elisha came into the house, and there was the boy laid out dead on his couch. He went in, shut the door behind the two of them, and prayed to the Lord. Pay attention, pray to the Lord. Only three words or four words are dedicated to the prayer. But see what's happening now. Then he mounted the bed and placed himself over the child. He put his mouth on his mouth, his eyes on its eyes, and his hands on its hands as he bent over it. And the body of the child became warm. He stepped down, walked once up and down the room, then mounted and bent over him. Thereupon the boy sneezed seven times, and the boy opened his eyes. Elisha called Gehazi and said, call the Shunammite woman, and he called her, etc., etc., and the child was brought back to life. When you read this story, you see that actually the prayer is mentioned there just because it's not very nice to say that Elisha could perform a miracle without actually calling God first. But on the other hand, the impression we get that he is actually performing an act of magic. And you know what's the difference between miracle and magic? Miracle is an act performed by God. Magic is something you can learn in any good school of magic, any academy in Egypt, in Babylon. You can learn, you can graduate, you can get a degree, BM, Bachelor in Magic. That's something that we can all learn. And the Bible has a problem with the concept of magic. Magic is for them. Miracle is for us. So let's see how a very similar story is being told about Eliyahu in 1 Kings chapter 17, verses 17 to 24, which is number 10 on our handout. And soon enough, you'll understand why I skipped number 10, went first to number 11, and then returned to number 10. The story, it's a very similar story. Again, there is a woman who shows hospitality to our prophet, to Eliyahu. Her son dies, she complains, and he brings the son back to life. Give me the boy. I start with the fifth line, I guess. Give me the boy, he said to her, and taking him from her arms, he carried him to the upper chamber. The upper chamber. The upper chamber was also mentioned in the Elisha story. But in the Elisha story, we expected it to happen in the upper chamber because the upper chamber was there from the very beginning of the story. She made the upper chamber for Elisha. You know that in Chekhov, the Russian playwright, in Chekhov's plays, a gun hanging on the wall in the first scene will shoot in the third. So an upper chamber mentioned in the beginning of the story will play a role towards the end. But here in the Elijah story, the upper chamber comes out, you know, it's out of the blue. It was not mentioned earlier, which is quite surprising. So anyway, so he carried him to the upper chamber where he was staying and laid him down on his own bed. He cried out to the Lord and said, O Lord, my God, will you bring calamity upon this widow whose guest I am and let her son die? Then he stretched out over the child three times and cried out to the Lord, saying, O Lord, my God, let the child's life return to this boy. The Lord heard Elijah's plea, the child's life returned to his body, and he revived. Now you see the difference between the two stories. The different proportions. In the Elisha story, the prayer was not meaningful. The act was the most impressive element. On the other hand, in the Elijah story, there is almost no act. He stretched out over the child three times. But before that and after that, we get the prayer of Elijah. What does it mean? Now, if we continue reading, Elijah is bringing him down from the upper room into the main room. He gives him to his mother. And now the mother say, "Now I know that you are a man of God and that the word of the Lord is truly in your mouth." Elijah is being referred to as the man of God. Now, if you read carefully 1 Kings from chapter 17 to chapter 19, you'll see that that's the only time Elijah is being referred to as the man of God. On the other hand, that's the common way to refer to Elisha in the Elisha cycle. So I have many reasons to believe that originally this story was indeed told about Elisha. And then, of course, how can you tell such a story about the disciple and not tell a similar story about the master? You don't want the master to look pale in comparison to his disciple. And one very good reason to think that this story was originally told about Elisha and only then about Eliyahu, I told you earlier, Elijah is not a very nice guy in the book of Kings. Elisha is the nice guy who does all these good things, you know, who feed people who don't have enough food, who make sure that poisonous food will become edible again. Elisha is the one who's bringing people back to life even after his death. So of course this story was told originally about him, and only later on it was told also about Eliyahu. And this way Eliyahu starts getting a facelift already within the Bible. At least one act of chesed about Elijah within the book of Kings. Now, another option, of course, what else? So, living forever and ever, making it up to heaven, coming back from the dead. But what about most of us? What expects most of us when we end this phase? Well, there is a very nice tradition, a lament in the book of Isaiah, chapter 14, number 12 on your handouts. It's a lament, but actually it's a pseudo-lament. It's a parody on a lament. It's a parody on the death of the king of Babylon. Well, the king of Babylon is the last person on earth for whom we will feel sorry. You know, the king of Babylon, it's like Saddam Hussein. That's the kind of person. So, of course, we are not feeling sorry for him. But what do we tell about him? Sheol. Oh, what's Sheol? Sheol is the nether world. Sheol is the nether world. And in Sheol, we still exist. We all get down to Sheol, to this nether world. And there is some kind of existence in Sheol. What kind of existence? What happens in Sheol? Let's see. So we are talking to this king. Sheol below was a steer to greet your coming, rousing for you the shades of all earth's chieftains, raising from their thrones all the kings of nations. Meaning all of them exist. All of them have their thrones down in Sheol. Sheol is quite a parallel world to ours. We finish our job here, we go on down there, but the king remains a king. A king who had a throne here has a throne down there. A professor who had a chair at the university here will have a chair at the university down there. Interesting. So what do they say to him? "All speak up and say to you, so you have been stricken as we were. You have become like us. Once you thought in your heart, I'll climb to the sky." You see, again, the same concept, the same tradition. The king of Babylon believed he was so important that he will actually become like a god and make it up to heaven. "I will climb to the sky. Higher than the stars of God I'll set my throne. I'll sit in the Mount of Assembly." The Mount of Assembly, meaning Har Moed, where all the gods meet. Something like the Olympus in the Greek mythology, the same thing. "On the summit of Tzafon, I'll mount on the back of a cloud. I will match the Most High." meaning he believes he'll match the Most High, he'll actually challenge the Most High. The Most High is God. That's what happens if you let people making it up to heaven. That's what happened when Jesus made it up to heaven, and indeed he became a deity. So most people make it to Sheol. Well, we continue some kind of existence down there. But here and there are some interesting traditions concerning Sheol, like number 13. It's a story about Korach and his gang. You know, the people who questioned, who challenged the authority of Moses, and their punishment is that actually they went down alive into Sheol, meaning the ground opened its big mouth, and they were all swallowed by the ground, and they were all eaten alive into Sheol. With all that belonged to them, the earth closed over them, and they vanished from the midst of the congregation. Well, now that you understand that we all exist down there, you have to ask another question. What do we eat there? Who will take care of our food supply? A very important question. You don't want to die after you have already died, but now of hunger. So what are we going to do about food down there? So now you read under number 14, Psalm 106, they attached, meaning the Israelites in the wilderness, attached themselves to Baal Peor, they worshipped idols, ate sacrifices offered to the dead. The Bible doesn't talk about it a lot. The Bible doesn't want to talk about it. Again, the Bible is an expression of normative religion, and our normative religion does not agree with the idea that we feed the dead. But again, there is a huge difference between normative religion and popular religion. People were offering food to the dead. And an indirect piece of evidence to this custom you find in the book of Deuteronomy, of all places, in the book of Deuteronomy. In the book of Deuteronomy, number 15 on your list, you have a tradition, you know, whenever you bring a tithe to the temple, you have to make a declaration. And what is the declaration? I have not eaten of it while in mourning. I have not cleared out any of it while I was unclean. And I have not deposited any of it with the dead. Meaning, whatever I bring to God, the tithe I bring to God, I am not allowed to deposit with the dead. But the 90% that I don't share with God, I am allowed to share with the dead. So you get an evidence that that's what we did. And now you understand that even after you die, you are in Sheol, you will be fed. Don't worry, be happy. Now we'll skip number 16. We are slowly approaching the end. Some of you are already in a different world, but I'm making it to the end. Yeah, so now I've talked about some unlegitimate, you know, ways to survive after death. But what are the legitimate ways for us? And the legitimate way for us to survive, or the way every one of us will survive, is through his or her children. And the concept is, for instance, expressed under number 17. That's a story about the wise woman from Tekoa. She tries to convince King David to let Absalom, who killed his brother Amnon, come back, because of course people want to kill Absalom to take revenge because he killed his brother Amnon. But if they kill Absalom, then of course David will lose two sons. And the Tekoite woman is trying to convince David that Absalom should not be killed. They should let Absalom come back. And she tells him actually a fable, as if she is telling her own life story. She comes to him and complains and tells him that one of her sons killed the other one, killed his brother, and the family the tribe, they now want to put the other guy to death for slaying his brother, even though we wipe out the heir. Thus they would quench the last ember remaining to me and leave my husband without name or remnant upon the earth. Meaning, if you kill the other son, the father who has died will not have a son on earth. There will be no continuity to the family. There will be no memory to the family. And pay attention to the fact that in Hebrew, the word zikaron, memory, and the word zachar, male, are related to one another. Meaning, a male offspring is one's memory on earth. I'm sorry, it's not politically correct, but I cannot do anything about the Hebrew language of 3,000 years ago. But for them, a male offspring was the one and only memory. Now, let's finish with the book of Ruth. In the book of Ruth, you know that the problem is, of course, Naomi and her husband Elimelech. There is famine in the land of Canaan. They have to leave the country. Perhaps they don't have to leave the country, but they leave the country anyway. And they go to Moab. And of course, Elimelech dies, and the two sons of Naomi die. And then the daughters-in-law decide to follow their mother-in-law back to the land of Canaan. Who says that there are no miracles in the book of Ruth? A daughter-in-law follows her mother-in-law. But anyway, at the beginning of the story, we are given the names of the two sons. The names of the two sons are Mahlon and Kilion. What's the meaning of the names? Mahlon, derived from machala, disease. Kilion, from Kilion, extinction. Bad names. I wouldn't have sold insurance to these guys carrying these names. You know, of course, what can you wait? What can you expect? You know, nomen est omen, as we say in good Latin. One's name is one's destiny. So, of course, the two children die, and then their wives, the widows, want to follow their mother-in-law. The mother-in-law succeeds in convincing one of them, Orpah, to stay behind, to stay in Moab, but Ruth follows her mother-in-law to the land of Canaan. Now, we don't know, actually, who was married to whom. Only when we get to chapter 4, to the very end of the story, we learn that under number 20, when Boaz is saying at the gate of the city, when I acquire now the land of Elimelech, of Naomi, I also acquire now Ruth the Moabite, the wife of Mahlon. Now the secret is being revealed to us. And what difference does it make? Well, you know, there is still a difference between disease and extinction. Some people still, you know, recover from a disease, but from extinction, there is no way back. And Ruth was the wife of Mahlon. Now that Ruth is married to Boaz, the first son of Boaz will be actually named after Mahlon. He'll be considered to be the son of Mahlon. It's a type of levirate marriage, a custom we learn about from the book of Deuteronomy. So Mahlon will have a son. Mahlon recovers from his disease. But of course, Kilion does not recover. His wife is not getting remarried. There is no continuity to his line. Of course, there are also some other ways, but I see that you are already very tired. We'll stop now. So we saw that actually in the Bible, despite the trend of, you know, mainstream biblical religion to hide all these mythological elements which are very close to paganism, still we get these concepts of immortality, resurrection, making it up to heaven, and even Sheol, which is not a very popular thing for the Bible to speak about, and especially it's not very popular in the Bible to speak about the food we are going to eat there. The only legitimate way for the Bible for us to continue our life is through our children. And if you are hungry after I've talked about eating in Sheol, I'm sure that there is an oneg soon enough, you'll be able to eat. If you have any questions, comments, objections, anything, don't be afraid. You're too tired.